From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The big story, all eyes are on Washington as the House prepares to vote on sending articles of impeachment to the Senate. It's the next step in the process to impeach President Trump. We'll have more on what we can expect. But first, today's developments come on the heels of a dramatic presidential primary debate. Democrats met late last night in Des Moines, Iowa, and NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro joins us with a recap. And Domenico, there were some notable differences from early debates. Of course, far fewer candidates, and some were pretty subdued as well. What's your big takeaway?
Well, sure. Yeah. Having, fewer candidates really gave you a deeper discussion among the top tier, which because we've had so many candidates, you really haven't gotten that. And I think voters now probably have a more manageable number to hear some of what they, might want to hear from those top candidates. Mm-hmm. That was a pretty substantive debate. You know, you saw once again, though, this progressive versus moderate split on some key issues. I mean, whether we're talking about foreign policy, healthcare, trade, it was really all night, mostly former Vice President Biden and former Mayor Pete Buttigieg against the ideologies of Bernie Sanders of Vermont and Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. You know, the big question going into last night, though, was about this Sanders-Warren sort of divide, and would they drop this non-aggression pact that they've had during this campaign when it came to whether a woman could win the presidency in this meeting that that Sanders and Warren had in late 2018.
Yes.
They mostly played nice last night and sort of dropped some of that drama. Warren had a nice line about the only people on stage who hadn't lost an election were the women on stage,
and
Amy Klobuchar.
Yeah.
There was some drama afterward because it appeared Warren didn't shake Sanders' hand, and they appeared to have some tense words after the debate.
Yeah, yes, definitely. I want to talk to you also more about those issues, but let's talk for a second about Joe Biden.
Mm-hmm.
He's still the leader in national polls. Here he is making the case for himself.
I have overwhelming support from the African-American community, overwhelming, more than everybody else in this operation, number one. Number two, working class people where I come from in Pennsylvania and the places I come from in Delaware, I have great support. I have support across the board, and I'm not worried about taking on Donald Trump at all.
Domenico, what did we hear from him on some of those big issues you brought up?
Yeah, you know, he towed the pragmatic line once again on foreign policy. He talked about not abandoning the Middle East, warning that ISIS would reconstitute itself if the U.S. pulled all troops out. He, of course, argued for less expansive changes to health care than Sanders and Warren, which he's done throughout the campaign. What was really interesting, we didn't hear from Biden as much as Warren, Sanders, or even Klobuchar last night, as far as speaking times go.
Yep.
But, you know, it's less important, frankly, what Biden says as opposed to how he says it.
Do you think that went over?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, on that front, I think he was okay. He wasn't as crisp or sharp as he was in last month's debate, but probably his supporters certainly not abandoning him or gave them any reason to really wring their hands last night.
You know, one topic that also dominated in light of the Trump administration's escalation with Iran is foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first topics really out of the gate was the 2002 Iraq war vote. What positions did the candidates take on Iran and the war and the Middle East more broadly?
Yeah, it was really pretty remarkable that the first 30 minutes of the debate were dominated by foreign policy. That's a quarter of the debate. And Democratic voters don't really rank foreign policy as among their top issues. Generally, that's healthcare, climate change. But, you know, with Iran tensions in the news, it's really a reminder that when Americans vote, they're voting for a commander in chief. And again, here you had that split between Biden with Buttigieg on one side and Sanders and Warren on the other. Warren said that she would fight the defense industry, quote, revolving door with the Pentagon, called to get combat troops out of the region. And of course, Biden again said he thought that, you know, getting all troops out would be a mistake.
Yeah, you mentioned Elizabeth Warren and her talking about whether a woman could win. Electability came up a lot last night. Biden maintains he's the candidate to win some of the key swing states. With a little bit of time I have with you, what do you think the candidate's messages were on electability?
Well, it was certainly a clever line from Warren to be able to talk about the fact that they'd all combined lost, the men on stage had lost 10 elections and the only
she
ones
did make that
to
point,
be
yeah.
undefeated were the women. You know, Buttigieg, I think, was interesting because he was less strong in talking about how he aims to win over black voters. It's been a key challenge for him. It's even been the butt of some jokes on Saturday Night Live and other places. And I think that's going to be a key thing for him in particular to get over, for as much attention as we've been talking about Elizabeth Warren and her gender and whether she can win. You know, it should be noted that when we asked people in our polling, what are some of the most favorable qualities that you want in a candidate? Being a woman was right at the top of the list.
Interesting. That's interesting. So much more there and many topics they did not bring up as well. We'll be talking more about that later. That's NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thanks as always.
Hey, you're welcome.
So as an election looms, we're closer to just the third presidential impeachment trial in our history today. Two articles of impeachment will literally be walked from the House to the Senate later today. President Trump facing charges of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress in connection with his phone call with the president of Ukraine, in which he asks him to do us a favor and investigate Joe Biden, who's, of course, his potential 2020 rival. And the president's later demand that those closest to that moment not testify in the House impeachment. President Trump denies any wrongdoing. Let's bring in Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. And Julian, we ask you to come in for your view through the history of the prism of history. Through that prism, where does this day stand for you?
Well, this is a rare moment. We've only had this happen two other times. And now the president will face a trial in the Senate, and that trial is whether he should be removed from office. So whatever happens, whatever the partisan outlook, this is still a very historic moment in congressional and presidential history.
Well, I'm wondering, you know, it feels that way to you as an historian, but do you think it feels that way to the electorate, or is there something missing? I've been trying to figure out if it's just that there's been so much coming at us, you could even say since, you know, 9/11. You know, you could say there's just been so much. I don't know. Are you feeling what a day like this should feel like?
Well, you're correct. We are inundated with information in this day and age. And so it's possible to live through historic moments, many Americans, without totally noticing or absorbing them. But it is notable to see polls that show between 45 and 51% of the country think the president should be impeached and removed from office. That suggests that this is having an impact. And so you are correct. But on the other hand, I do think there's evidence that the weight of what's happening is sinking in with some Americans.
Well, but then you had Majority Leader Mitch McConnell saying there can only be one outcome of this trial, no conviction for Donald Trump, saying he wouldn't call witnesses. And then yesterday saying, well, if the Democrats do, maybe Republicans should call Hunter Biden. I'm paraphrasing there, but he was asked, would Hunter Biden be called? Talk about, you know, the elements that can make it an even more powerful event, which, of course, include witnesses. Talk about that historically.
Well, obviously, if four Republican senators actually broke with the leader and insisted on having witnesses or some kind of deal on witnesses, that would be big news, given that Republicans have all followed McConnell pretty religiously from the start and been supportive of the president. And hearing testimony from officials very high up, like Bolton, John Bolton, would also have a level of drama because it would supplement the documentation or the other witnesses we have heard.
Well, he was
that
in the
said,
room.
All of this is counterbalanced with the power of partisanship, which is equally intense and is shaping the dynamic in the Republican caucus right now.
Yeah, saying Bolton was in the room where it happened, and Republicans have been asking for that, and he's saying, I want to come. What about House managers? What role do they play?
Well, they're basically going to make the case to the Senate and to the American public. I think the latter is probably more important. They will lay out what we know. They will review what happened in the hearings, and they will also talk about documents such as the ones released last night. And they will try to build public pressure in those swing states on Republicans in places like Colorado, like Senator Gardner, and try to get a little movement. I think in the end they don't expect, you know, the Senate to remove President Trump, but they want to make clear what the president did and the vote that Senate Republicans are about to take when they defend him.
And just think of past moments like this. We weren't there for Andrew Johnson, but many of us were for Bill Clinton. Richard Nixon, of course, left office before there could be a trial. But is there a moment that jumps out that you're thinking there might be a parallel here?
It's hard. I mean, we only have a few cases, and we don't know if this will feel a little bit like when the House Judiciary Committee voted on the articles for Nixon, which was kind of the final step, but you felt the weight of what they were doing. Or will it feel more like 98 when Bill Clinton is impeached, and then in 99 there's a Senate trial, but it just felt like partisanship run amok. And I don't know what this is going to feel like to most Americans, but I think that's part of the political story.
And if the Senate votes 53-47, which is the partisan split, not to convict, does that mean this didn't matter?
No, it mattered. He is formally impeached. That's part of the historical legacy. And in the impeachment process, the Democrats have outlined how he used presidential power, and that will be part of the textbooks.
Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Like millions of Black Americans, my grandparents migrated from the southern states of America, in our case Mississippi, and moved throughout the nation in search of a better life. It was a stunning shift for our country. Over six decades, this massive migration, known as the Great Migration, shaped the economic, demographic, and cultural landscape of our nation as we know it today. Author Blair Imani chronicles this moment in history in her new book, Making Our Way Home, The Great Migration and the Black American Dream, and she joins us now to talk about it. And Blair, there have been other books on the Great Migration, Isabel Wilkerson's The Warmth of Other Suns, for example, but your book is different in that it looks and reads sort of like a graphic novel. Why did you decide to write it this way?
Well, I really, myself, am someone who likes to envision things. And I think it's important that the predominant folks in the book are folks who are brown-skinned Black people, when myself being a light-skinned Black person, really thinking about how privilege shows up in the way that we even depict Black stories. So, for example, I talk about colorism throughout the book and talk about things like passing for white, etc. But instead of depicting those people, because we often see folks who look like me, I wanted to show a wide array of Black folks who are brown-skinned, who come from different backgrounds, and not just celebrities either, but everyday Black people. So that's really where I was coming from. But, you know, at a basic level, I think that a book with illustrations is more approachable to a wider audience. And I wanted to make sure this got into the hands of as many people as possible.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit more. You know, I could see this being used in schools. Was that your intention?
Absolutely. You know, I didn't have Black history really robust in my schools. I had kind of like home teaching in terms of Black history, where my parents would kind of complement whatever I was learning in school. And I've seen my younger cousins' history books, and they're more robust in terms of representation. But how honest are they? And I think that's really the thing to interrogate. And so I have a glossary in the back of the book, so that way everything is kind of laid out in a way that's approachable again. And it's written at about a fifth or sixth grade level, which is what most Americans' reading level is at. And so that being said, I just wanted to make sure it was accessible.
Talking more about the content of the book, you write that you would often joke that thanks to this incomplete history, it felt like Black people kind of disappeared from the face of the earth during World War I and World War II, only to return with music and afros and righteous indignation in the late 50s, that basically we learned very little about what happened after slavery and before the civil rights movement. I mean, was that like at the core of writing this book? What led you to want to talk about that particular space and time?
Just the fact that so much happened and so little is written. I remember being in an American history course, even in college, and we, you know, did our chapter on the 1920s, and there was no mention on the Harlem Renaissance. And so, like, I was looking at the syllabus, and I was like, oh, well, clearly I've missed something. Like, there's no way that the teacher omitted this. Maybe there was, like, a class that I missed or something. And I went to the teacher, and he was like, oh, I guess that's important. And I was like, I guess, you know, like you're teaching to a predominantly in a predominantly black neighborhood. You know, Baton Rouge is a majority black city. And yet the attendance at Louisiana State University where I attended was about 12%. So clearly there's a gap, you know, and it's showing up in the curriculum. Mm. And also the fact that as I was doing the research for this book, I'm realizing that, hey, if 40% of farm workers at this time period during the Great Depression were black people, why are all the stories that we hear, like Grapes of Wrath, you know, Dust Bowl, different documentaries, why are they only focusing on these white folks? So it was just kind of those things where it's like, okay, I thought I was aware of all the gaps, but there's even more.
Yeah. One thing that was really striking for me in this book as well was the framing. I mean, oftentimes the framing is shaped by hardship and suffering, but you really want it to tap into as well some of the things that we celebrate about our culture and the people that we celebrate. And I want to talk more about that, but I want to talk about your family and your family's reasoning for moving from the South to LA. Tell us a little bit about your own family story.
So I remember one night when I had brought over all my American Girl dolls to my grandmother's house, and she was looking at the story of Addie, who was one of the, I think, only Black American dolls that they have in that series.
Back then when you were younger.
Yeah, when I was younger. And so I was telling her about Addie's story, and then she starts telling me about her own, which happened in around the 1930s. You know, she was born in 1929, and she starts telling me about how my great-grandfather had to collect all of his belongings and flee because there was a lynching in their city in Little Rock, Arkansas. And the Klan had basically, you know, lynching is a form of mass intimidation. And in this particular case, the Klan said, and if any slur goes to work tomorrow, you'll be dead, just like this one. And my great-grandfather, and everyone says I'm so much like him, he decides to go to work the next day because he's not going to be intimidated. He has a family to provide for. So he goes into work. The owner of the store where my great-grandfather works, he gets word that my great-grandfather is going to be killed. And he doesn't want to see that happen. It was a white man. And he gave Big Daddy his car and he said, get out of here. Like, go. Just go. And it wasn't like you could just pick up and leave, you know?
He had a family.
He had a family. And it was this big moment of, does he leave or does he stay and does he die? And that could be the end of the story right there. But he picks up and he leaves. And it was really kind of a community coming together, people cooking and making sure that his car was full of food, making sure that his family would be taken care of because they had to get out of that house regardless of whether or not my great grandmother or my grandma could go with him.
Yeah.
So they basically evacuated, spread the family out. And that's why we live in Pasadena because he came out to Pasadena. And so it's really difficult to talk about. But I wanted to open the book with that story because it's why I'm here. And that's profound.
Okay, now I want to get to the joy that we see in this book. So many of the stories of the cultural contributions of Black Americans in film, music, and literature, there's so many in this book. How difficult was it for you to balance both the beautiful and the ugly? But then also with the beautiful, there's so many stories. How did you choose them?
Well, I think, you know, that's even the chapter title of chapter two, Beautiful and Ugly Too, which is a line from Langston Hughes' essay, The Negro Artist and the Racial Mountain. And the 1920s really exemplifies this and was a great starting place for me because there's a lot of research and a lot of chronicling of what happened during the Harlem Renaissance, but it often omits LGBTQ contributions. So I was like, okay, well, it's time to queer the Harlem Renaissance and really talk about how the first magazine that was created by Black and LGBTQ people and folks of those intersections was called Fire, and it was created in 1926.
Blair, can I say something?
Yes.
You know, as a child reading about the Harlem Renaissance, there was always an inkling that am I missing another part of this story? And it was the LGBTQ story. That was the story that was missing.
And I talk about how it was like this point at which it was crucial for Black folks to cast off every element that white society had thrust upon us, including heteronormativity and gender expectations. And I wanted to lift that up. But then also it was a time where lynching and violence was really peaking, the nadir of American history in terms of race relations. So Beautiful and Ugly Too speaks to that there's so much beauty happening in the 1920s in particular, but so much ugliness. And then throughout the book, it was really difficult to kind of zero in on moments that were crucial. But I also, kind of going to distribution of privilege, I wanted to talk about how Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte were contemporaries, for example. But because of colorism, Harry Belafonte was imbued with more desirability. And so instead of depicting him in the book, I decided to depict Sidney Poitier, and also uplift how Ebony was kind of one of the few magazines that were depicting people, and how mm-hmm. even though these movies were happening in black and white, Dorothy Dandridge was mm-hmm. lifted up higher than, you know, some of her darker hued sisters, and how Lena Horne even spoke to this. Yeah. So I thought of how I could add to existing conversations that folks are more in touch with in terms of black pop culture, and look at how I could contribute to that space by deconstructing it, by looking at it from an LGBTQ lens, from a privilege lens, looking at it from classism and colorism, and dive into that.
Blair, you mentioned wanting to queer the Harlem Renaissance. In fact, there are stories of members of the LGBTQ community throughout the book. For example, you have Bayard Rustin, the openly gay civil rights activist who was excluded from speaking at the March on Washington. These stories were important for you to tell.
Oh, absolutely. You know, myself, I'm a bisexual black Muslim woman, and, I have some skin in the game, clearly. But I think, too, it's important to show other folks. You know, I remember explaining to my parents why the bathroom bill in North Carolina mattered to them, and how, you know, bathrooms were segregated by race and they are now segregated by gender, and how social categorization is harmful to everyone. And so it really became important to me not only to include, but also to elevate. You know, Barbara Jordan was a lesbian, you know, that's important because there's such a conversation now that says, oh, this is a new phenomenon. Oh, this has come out of nowhere. This is novel. It's a trend. That's what I hear often from older folks, is that it's a trend. But it's not. It's, yeah. You know, it's part of black history. It's part of American history.
And it seems you were intentional in conveying this message, even in the artwork.
Oh, yeah. So there's this fun little Easter egg. If you look at the cover, you know, at the binding, you have my Uncle Lester. You have a partner that we've given him. He came out later in life. He was a gay black man, but he never got to live his life out and openly because of social climates. And so we gave Uncle Lester a partner. Right in the center, you have my great aunt, my great uncle, Clarence and Carmen. And at the end, you have myself and my partner, myself being a queer woman and Uncle Lester being at the end. And I think that's a nice bookend to have. And I just love the idea of people picking up this book because they love black history, but then also realizing that they have a gay couple on the front of this book. And it shows that we are of diverse and multifaceted people, and all of our stories matter.
Blair Imani's book is Making Our Way Home, The Great Migration and the Black American Dream. Blair, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The FAA is investigating why a Delta plane bound for Shanghai dumped jet fuel on an elementary school playground yesterday in Southern California while the pilot was making his emergency return to Los Angeles International Airport. Paramedics treated dozens of children and adults for minor injuries. Well, here now is transportation analyst Seth Kaplan has some thoughts and sounds like some questions. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Robin.
Well, good. The plane was a Delta Flight 89. It apparently experienced engine problems right after takeoff and had to immediately turn back. Do we know why?
Well, an engine suffered what's called a compressor stall. Basically, the engine stopped working. That can happen for a number of reasons. A bird strike, for example, during takeoff would be one reason. Not terribly uncommon to have engine issues. Not terribly uncommon even to dump fuel. I mean, the reason we're talking about this story here on the radio is because of where that fuel was dumped. That's the part that's unusual.
Right. I mean, before an emergency landing, if you've ever been through one, they're very scary. They do have to dump fuel. Then there's all these ambulances and foam on the runway. It's kind of scary. But this flight had 13 hours of fuel because it was going to Shanghai. So it really couldn't have landed with an engine problem with that much fuel, right?
Not safely, exactly. And so that's why this would have been perhaps a little more dramatic than, say, a two-hour flight. Airlines calculate how much fuel is on board based on, of course, how much fuel they need to get to wherever they're going. But also, you want to have less than a certain amount of fuel when you land.
Yeah.
And so they absolutely would have had to dump some of that fuel.
So thankfully, everybody on board okay. But, you know, people on the ground injured. People immediately took to social media to question the decision to dump it over the school. Do they have a choice? What are the rules here?
Well, the FAA came out pretty soon after, and emphasized that there are special fuel dumping procedures that, quote, call for fuel to be dumped over designated unpopulated areas and typically at higher altitudes. So, you know, that can be the ocean when possible or just places where there aren't people. Delta, in its statement, said that this was, quote, part of normal procedures. Now, again, dumping fuel is normal. Delta said, quote, it shares concerns regarding reported minor injuries to adults and children at a school in the area. Now, I asked them to help me try to reconcile this, you know, what the FAA said and the idea that this was a normal procedure. And Delta said simply that this is an ongoing investigation.
Yeah. Well, Delta generally has a good safety record. So I want your thoughts on whether you think this is going to damage Delta. It probably will in that neighborhood. But what about the plane's owners? This was a Boeing 777, not a Boeing MAX, which has been grounded. But elsewhere in the program, we're going to talk about those devastating emails that were released that showed Boeing, showed Boeing employees just disdainful about safety and about customers and other airlines. I found myself thinking, I don't know if I want to fly Boeing. This was a Boeing plane.
It was. And I think this is more a Delta issue than a Boeing issue. And you're right. Delta enjoys a rather good reputation. So on one hand, it gets maybe some benefit of the doubt. It's not an airline where people say, oh, not Delta again. On the other hand, you know, reputations are earned over years and ruined quickly. So it has to respond to this the right way, you know, show a lot of concern, address whatever happens to make sure it doesn't happen again. In terms of Boeing, you're right. I mean, this clearly unrelated to everything else, but this is a company that when things are going wrong, people do tend to pile on, and unhelpful to have any kind of bad news involving Boeing, you know, even something that, you know, in this case, we wouldn't be talking about if not for the issue with dumping the fuel on the school.
That's right. Seth Kaplan, Here Now's transportation analyst. Thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin.
Jeremy Hobson is in Concord, New Hampshire today, talking with voters about last night's debate among Democrats running for president. Hey, Jeremy.
Hi, Tanya. And as you know, Iowa goes first with its caucuses on February the 3rd. That's where the debate was last night. New Hampshire follows with its primary on February 11th. So we have gathered three New Hampshire Democrats to get their thoughts on the debate last night. One is Davis Bernstein, who's president of the Keene State College Democrats. He's 21. Hi, Davis.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing well. Another voter with us is retired Dr. Lynn Painter of Concord, 67 years old. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Jeremy.
And Samaya Kashi is also with us, a teacher from Concord, New Hampshire, 39 years old. Hi, Samaya.
Hi.
Okay, so let me go around the studio here and ask you, who did you like going in and who do you think did the best last night? I'll start with you, Davis.
Sure. So I still like Warren and Bernie. I find myself to be more progressive in most situations, and I didn't necessarily enjoy their feud last night. So I don't think either of them came out on top, but I think they did do the best. Both of them did the best out of the six.
Okay. And Samaya, what about you? Who did you like going in and who do you think did the best?
So I went in for Bernie and I came out kind of confused after the feud between him and Warren. And then I really actually liked Pete Buttigieg. I thought he was really strong last night. He sounded really confident. And so that was kind of impressive. And it made me take a second look at him.
And when you say confused, what do you mean by that?
Well, I felt like Bernie didn't really give me any solutions to any issues. He sort of told us what the problems were. Warren did have a few moments where she was talking about some of her ideas of what she would like to do. And Pete Buttigieg did as well. So that's why I was a little confused. But I, you know, on book, I typically vote for Bernie.
Okay. And Lynn, what about you? Who did you like going in and who do you think did the best?
I've been pretty undecided. I really find that this is such a strong group of candidates. I'm happy with any of them as president at this point. I would love to see that change happen anytime. Going in, I've been lately leaning more toward Bernie, interestingly, although I want to see a woman on the ticket. And I do think Elizabeth is a very strong candidate, too. So I'm kind of it boils down for me to tactics and thinking of Donald Trump standing next to somebody on a debate stage and who's going to be able to swing with his tactics and come out strong. That's really more how I'm thinking about it because I don't see that the different individuals are going to make that huge a difference.
Davis and Samaya, as you listened there, I saw you nodding when she said that she'd like to support any of these candidates. Do you agree with that? Would you support any of them or are there any that you wouldn't vote for over Trump?
Gosh, no. we would vote for anyone. I mean, I would. Yeah.
Oh, no, me too. Okay. Vote blue no matter who.
One of the issues that came up last night, and it started the debate, was the Iraq war and the Afghanistan war and the votes for both. Do votes that were taken by, let's say, Joe Biden, who voted in favor of the Iraq war, or Bernie Sanders, who voted against it back in 2002, do those votes matter to you right now, Davis?
I'd say so, yeah, especially when it comes towards the general election. We saw what Trump did to Hillary in 2016. He attacked her very hard for her pro-vote on the Iraq war, even though he was lying. He was also in favor for it at times. But I think it's better to have a nominee that has a really clean record and didn't vote for a disastrous war that has been going on for almost my entire lifetime.
Lynn?
Yeah, I feel very similarly. I love Joe Biden. I've always been an admirer of his. I'm disappointed in how he comes across on the debates. I don't see him as being at the same level of sort of verbal intensity and articulateness these days, although I think his record, aside from that vote and aside from the vote on incarceration, the crime bill that is a problem for him in this election, I think his record is a fine record overall. I wouldn't have a problem with him, but I think overall it's a real strength of Bernie Sanders to have had that insight.
Samaya?
I agree with both of them.
You're Iranian American,
I am,
by the way.
I am. That's a really hot topic for me because – before they went to war with Iraq, I was in New York City protesting. It was still one of my darkest times. I remember that experience. I was dating somebody from Iraq, and he also was telling me experiences from his family in Iraq. So I knew the backstory. I knew what's going on in the Middle East. And I said, again, the United States going into the Middle East and causing more problems. And so I was very much against it. So that's an issue for me, that he had voted for it, and there was a lot of people who were very much against it, and it was clear there was nothing in Iraq before they went into war.
Let me ask you about health care. That came up again last night, as it has in a number of debates. I'll start with you, the doctor, Lynn. Medicare for all or something more incremental seems to be the question in the party right now. Where do you stand?
I have been a member of various organizations in favor of a single-payer health system since the 70s. I really think that's where we need to be heading. I think that the way it's being framed right now is difficult because I believe that the way Pete Buttigieg expresses his plan, which is Medicare for all who want it and allow there to be a transition voluntarily based on offering something great and better, that is ideal.
You like that better than just kicking people off of their health insurance?
First of all, it's not going to be about what they say on the campaign trail. It's about what can you get done. I don't believe we're going to get done getting rid of the insurance industry. So I think we need a practical approach. And I'm very torn because my ideal would be going to a single payer quite soon. But the person who says that on the campaign trail is not likely to be persuasive. That's my opinion.
Samaya?
Agree. I think it's going to be very hard to succeed in doing that. So we need something a little bit more level-headed, and it needs to be a kind of a slow transition.
Davis?
Yeah, I totally support Medicare for all, but I support what Elizabeth Warren says and says she'd sign in any bill that would ensure more uninsured Americans, and that's really important.
Let's finally talk about electability, because that has been the big question about who would be the most able to beat President Trump. Who do you think that person is?
Well, first of all, I always have an issue with electability arguments. This happens every election, and it always gets turned on its head. Currently, I think Warren and Sanders both have broad support, especially Sanders. He has a lot of support between independents and even some Republicans.
Sumaya?
I'm going to go with what Davis said exactly.
You think Warren and Sanders are the most electable?
They are. Pete, I think he just started off. I mean, he's just young. I don't really know much
Biden?
About him. But Biden, that's a hard one. I mean, I think he's done his time. There are some things he has in his history that I'm not all that happy about, some of the choices he had made. So he's definitely not in one of the ones I would choose as my top three. But
do you think that he would be more electable than the others?
I'd say that anyone I've talked to on the Democrat side, nobody's really
excited about
Biden. Yeah.
Lynn?
Yeah, I started out thinking Joe Biden would be the most electable. I no longer really think that. And when I weigh Elizabeth Warren versus Bernie Sanders, I kind of am not sure. I'm truly torn between those two options right now because I can see Bernie winning. Mm-hmm. I think I might very well have voted for Bernie last time. I allowed myself to be persuaded that there wasn't sufficient support mm-hmm. for him, and I think that was a mistake.
There is one candidate we have not talked about who could get into the race in a more serious way after the New Hampshire primary, and that's Mike Bloomberg. How do you feel about Mike Bloomberg? I'll go around the room. Davis.
I really don't think it should be possible to buy your way into the primary. And I also think he's regretting not getting into New Hampshire and some of the other early states, as some reports have said. I don't think you can put all of your eggs in California and Florida.
Sumaya?
Agree. I don't really know much about him, to be honest. So I have a hard time going in and voting for somebody I've really not seen.
Lynn?
Yeah, I kind of feel the same, although I do think he's been a pretty good mayor and he's got executive experience. He knows a lot about health care. So I'm not real negative on him, but I agree that the process hasn't been very satisfactory.
Are all of you excited about the fact that the New Hampshire primary is almost over, or is it kind of fun to be in the middle of it?
It's fun to be in the middle of it. I mean, it'll be great to have there be some resolution, but this is a great time to live in New Hampshire.
You both agree.
I agree. It's been exciting, but I'll be done with the 1-800 phone calls.
I mean, I've got to meet 20 candidates, but truthfully, I am so tired.
And that's not even all of them.
Yeah, no.
Well, Davis Bernstein, Lynn Painter, and Sumaya Kashi, thanks for coming in and talking with us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Last week, there were two whiplashing moments regarding Boeing and its handling of the 737 MAX, the plane that's been grounded because of two crashes that killed 346 people in Indonesia and Ethiopia. Crashes caused by lack of training for pilots on a new software system, a system that Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg finally admitted played a role before he was fired last December. Well, last week, Boeing announced it would reverse course and recommend simulator training for pilots. Then a few days later, internal emails were released showing a culture of putting costs before safety, awareness of the problem. One employee wrote, "Would you put your family on this plane? I wouldn't." And a disdain for regulators and airlines. Lion Air asked for pilot training. One employee called them idiots. Then a Lion Air 737 MAX crashed, killing all aboard. And the next year, an Ethiopia Airlines 737 MAX went down. Nadia Milleron and Michael Stumo's daughter, Samia, was on that flight. Nadia joins us from her home in Sheffield, Massachusetts. Hi, Nadia.
Hi.
And Michael joins us from Washington, D.C., where I know your daytime job takes you, Michael, but also now your full-time job, both of you, of fighting for safety and sorting out the debris that's left after a crash like this. Michael, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Robin.
And we've spoken before. You've told us of you know, walking through Washington, meeting closed doors from regulators and lawmakers. You knew something bigger was wrong with the Boeing culture. I can't imagine, but Nadia, you start. What was it like to read these emails?
Well, the most striking thing is what you mentioned, that they wouldn't put their own family members on the plane. Why are their family members different than our family members? That is so shocking to me. And they're not being transparent about safety and the review of the safety systems on the plane. And that's what Boeing needs to do.
Michael, they were also concerned about costs ahead of safety, and it would have cost to have simulator training. And here's what a manager wrote to his Boeing underlings. "I want to stress the importance of holding firm. There will not be any type of simulator training required to transition from the old system to the new one, the MAX system. Boeing will not allow that to happen. We'll go face to face with any regulator who tries to make that a requirement." I mean, that's stomach turning.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And in fact, after the second crash that killed Samia, the FAA still was doing Boeing's bidding by proposing just another hour of iPad training as a precondition to getting the MAX back up into the air. These emails show exactly what was going on.
I read these emails and the complete disdain for anybody outside of Boeing, the name calling, the mocking. I don't know that I ever want to fly on another Boeing plane. How do we know it's just the MACs?
You know that it's not just the MACs because you've seen other, you know, the 787
plant in Charleston, South Carolina, has had a lot of reported problems. But you know, something that in the future needs to be brought out is this self-regulation system where Boeing sets up its own FAA within itself called the Organization Designation Authority. That's only given to trusted manufacturers to self-regulate. They have obviously shown themselves not to be a trusted manufacturer and should have that FAA should and can pull that ODA designation and solve that even without legislation.
What do you think should happen here?
This is a culture that came from the board over the last 20 plus years from David Calhoun and the board members who set financial goals that were unattainable without cutting costs, cutting engineers. All they cared about was profits, apparently took on the culture of we don't care. And if, you know, someone dies, we hope not, but that's what happens.
It won't be my family, is what they're saying. Well, you mentioned David Calhoun, who was on the board. He's now been named chief executive following the firing of Dennis Muilenburg, who had been a Boeing's chief executive. Calhoun told employees in an email on Monday he sees opportunities to be better. But Nadia, these people are still there. I mean, how do you feel about that?
We can't have people in place who are responsible for these deaths, and that includes David Calhoun and the whole board. Everybody should stand up and make themselves heard as consumers, and that will make a change, believe me.
Nadia, I can't help but think when you say, you know, the word consumers, it popped it back into my mind that your uncle is Ralph Nader, who, of course, fought so hard for automotive safety when cars were blowing up. There's some irony there that somehow you are being forced on the front lines of demands for safety.
Yeah, it's a horrible irony that he knew about the problems with the MAX before Samia got on this plane and that he was starting to move to work on these very safety issues on this plane. So it is a terrible irony, but let's not have anybody else pay the price.
Nadia Milleron, Michael Stumo, their daughter Samia Stumo, died in the crash of Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 last March, and they're now part of many lawsuits demanding more safety from Boeing and government regulators. And Nadia, Michael, thank you so much for talking to us and for the work that you're doing, and I'm so sorry.
Thank you, Robin.
Thanks, Robin.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here Now. The impeachment process advances towards a Senate trial, and House Manager Adam Schiff is defending the decision to delay the process until now.
That time has been, I think, very effective in not only bringing new evidence to light, but also forcing senators to go on record.
The latest on impeachment, next time on Here and Now.